few more women judges, but I hope that, again, there's another lever to press on, because there are going to be judicial commissions which will be, over a period of time, selecting candidates, not selecting, but nominating candidates for the federal judiciary. And they should be, we hope they will be, sending more and more women, minority names, over there. Finally, I didn't mention ERA, and that's my greatest sin of all. As many of you know, certainly the administration, the Justice Department, is full-scale behind ERA, and recently you've probably read that we were pulled into the constitutional struggle in the Congress over the extension of ERA. For those of you that don't know, the Office of Legal Counsel, which is in the Justice Department and renders advice on constitutional questions to the Attorney General and on up through the President's counsel to the President, was given three critical questions to answer. One, could an extension of ERA, would it be constitutionally valid to have Congress pass a law extending the period of time? If it were, did that have to be done by two-thirds or a majority vote of both houses? These are all unique legal questions in that they have not arisen in precisely that form in our entire history. And third, if you did extend the period of time, would it be constitutionally possible for states which had originally adopted the amendment in the first period to rescind in the second period? I don't have to tell any of you the implications of all three of those questions. But they are indeed real constitutional law questions about. Those of you who followed the hearings in the subcommittee in the House know that you got some varying opinions. Our Justice Department, which our Office of Legal Counsel, which operates politically insulated in as constitutional scholars, et cetera, was, I am glad to say, after many anxious moments, able to answer all three questions, that yes, it is constitutionally valid for Congress to propose an extension. And two, if it does so, it can be by majority and not two-thirds vote. And three, a state does not have the right to rescind. So it, that's another aspect of the fight that we've been involved in. Now, I would be happy, I think Stuart would join me to answer any questions people have. Yes. Well, by no, let me say the bill was introduced not by us. Let me give you a little bit of the process. The bill was introduced by, I don't remember the exact number, but it was a large number of representatives in the House of Representatives. 14 out of the 18 women who are currently in the House of Representatives were what's known as co-sponsors of such a bill. There were also several male sponsors of it, including the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. I saw a list of those names. I'm not sure whether I have them here or not, but on one of the, I believe that the circular, which is the Now people are putting out right here, has got the full list, but there were 14, the ones I remember were Peggy Heckler and Liz Holtzman and I think, yeah, okay, yeah. Yes. Right, we talk status offenders. And what they do about that is,
Right.
Well, I can only give you some suggestions in my experience, because I have, when I was working as a lawyer, I worked with a fair amount in the juvenile field, so I am well aware of the problem. In fact, here in Texas, a couple of years ago, before they passed one of the statutory amendments, something like between 65 and 80% of the girls in the training schools, because I had occasion to go to them, were so-called status offenders. They were there as runaways or as people who had been caught living with their boyfriends. In other words, they had not committed a kind of crime that we associate with criminal activity. I think that, from my point of view, the best solution that I can see is, aside from prevention, preventive efforts, is when a child runs away and when they are apprehended, there ought to be a system, and there are in some places, of supervised runaway homes, small homes that are in the community where they can stay for a limited period of time until some attempt can be made to negotiate, to work out with the parents a means by which they can come back. And this does work. We've had several of them in Washington. In fact, HEW, and you may know more about this than I do, has a runaway program where they will fund, probably don't have enough money for it, but probably, I mean, to meet the real need, will fund localities in setting up these kind of runaway shelters. Now, I'm as aware of you, as you are, that unless they're done right, they could be just as bad as the detention home that they replace, and I think that's the responsibility of people in the community to make sure that doesn't happen. We do have several good ones, I know, in Washington, D.C., where the kids run away. They can go there. Two things. One, if the police pick them up and they really are endangered, then they can take them to the runaway house rather than home. They can spend enough time there. Usually it's just a week or 2 weeks, so that a counselor or somebody can call the parents, attempt to get the parents and the child together to work out a kind of solution, and the child never goes to court and never gets a juvenile court record. Maybe he'll run away again. I mean, these usually runaway signifies that, you know, there may be deeper causes to it. But I would rather that kind of in-between system myself, in which you attempt just to take care of the physical needs of the child, keep them out of these really corrupting detention institutions, and hope that you can work out something between the parents and the child. I've read about it.
Yeah.
I think there are an enormous number of innovative solutions that can be done for this. And I think it's just outrageous, in my opinion, that these, and it is the girls who, because there's just no question, status offenders are predominantly girls, runaways, so-called sexual acting out, et cetera. The girls' institutions, there may be an increase, I read about it, some increase in so-called violent crimes by female teenagers, but I'm not even sure whether that's true or not. I've heard varying interpretations of the statistics. But if you go into any detention home or any girls' institution, most of the girls are there because they couldn't get along with their parents or they ran away. They are not there for violent crimes. So that I think any reform of the juvenile justice system, which did not allow those so-called status offenders to be put into the same kind of training schools with relatively hardened delinquents, or into the detention homes, which are often worse than the training schools, would in fact be an enormous contribution to the women's rights movement. And I might say that another thing we picked up is that the kids who are in detention institutions and in training schools for non-criminal offenses stay there longer than the kids who are there for robbery and for housebreaking. And the reason they do is this: strangely enough, many of those outright delinquent kids have a home to go back to, I mean, or somebody, some place that will take them back. But the child who is at war with her parents and doesn't have the home to go back to ends up staying there interminably, and there's really got to be a better system for that. You mean now or under a kind of system which... Well, right now, if you have a traditional kind of system for status offenders, their parents can cite them to the court, and then the court can do if it decides it can't release them or the parents don't want them back. The only legal protection they have is that the court then places them someplace else. It could place them usually in a foster home if there were ones around that were good to take them, or in some kind of community-based program, but there usually aren't enough of those, so they end up out. If you call legal protection being in a training school, but no, I don't either. Now, let me suggest that there are people who have been thinking and working hard on this, and there is something, for instance, a group that I belong to for 4 or 5 years, the American Bar Association, the Institute of Judicial Administration that had LEAA funds, and they have set out, they've got 23 volumes which are now out and can be obtained about juvenile justice standards. One of those deals with how they think status offenders should be handled. And in that particular volume, and it's a very controversial volume, and actually it's opposed by most of the juvenile court judges, they just take the so-called status offender out of the juvenile court and make it handleable by a system of voluntary social work type, so that the child doesn't go to court, doesn't get a record. It's controversial because I know the argument on the other side, and there really is a balanced risk, which the court says, but, you know, if we can't get a hold of them, we can't do something for them, and we want to do the right thing for them, et cetera. So that, but basically, what it would allow is these kids who are runaways, et cetera, to be picked up, but to be brought only to non-secure or non-detention type facilities where they could stay while, what I said before, while these other systems, communication was being worked out with the parents. And if they couldn't work out communication with the parents, then one could go to court and try to set up something so whereby the child could live someplace for the period of time that was before they became an adult. By protection from their parents, are you talking about the abuse, neglect, exploitation? Well, that's a good question. We might all think the answer is yes, but it isn't always yes. In some cases, usually the parent has a support obligation for the child up to age, most people say age 8, most state statutes say age 18. However, there's a so-called exception to that in a lot of state statutes, which says that if the child is, quote, emancipated, and emancipated means he's out living by himself or handling his own affairs, then the support obligation stops in some cases. The state law is up and down. My own feeling of the way it should go is the parent should be, and I've said this, I've written this in some of these lines, the parent should be responsible for the child up to age 18, regardless of whether or not the situation has gotten so untenable that the child has had to move out and take on another mode of living. But right now, that's not always the law. Can I just try this lady in back and then you? I do sometimes. Sure. Listen, I could not agree with you more. I don't know enough to validate, and I certainly don't know enough to object to your statement that most of them go through the legal route. Among the 18 women in the House of Representatives, I haven't taken a poll, you may be able, but I know at least 6 or 7 who are not lawyers.
I personally think there are too many lawyers in Congress, and that's my observation after 9 months. Sometimes some of the most refreshing or kind of straight to the jugular approach comes from the non-lawyers who are there, rather than the people who sit down, you know, with the statutes and the drafting. I think we really ought to have more women. I think they ought to come from all walks of life. They should not. I think perhaps women in government are overrepresented in the legal profession. By that, I simply mean that a disproportionate number of the women presently in government are lawyers. I would like to see that turned around very much. It shouldn't be that way. The only thing I can put my finger on is the electoral process. I don't know whether the fact that you've been trained in the law or something means you've learned to talk even at such a great rate, even when you're not always sure what you're talking about, that it gives you some kind of an edge politically. But, you know, you're absolutely right. We need a much greater, I think a lot of our laws would make much more sense if they reflected more than the legal discipline. It's a very hard political call, and I want to tell you, I was enormously grateful that I didn't have to take the political call. I mean, we in the Department of Justice were asked to react legally to the fact that this was introduced by the women in Congress. I know why they did it. I can see, you know, and they did. They were fully aware of some of the political risks, and they and the organizations which supported them made the judgment call that they had more to gain than to lose. But I think they were well aware, as am I. I think it's really, well, I just don't see it clearly one way or the other as to how, where the chips will fall on it. I think that you may need that extra time. I think our lawyers tell us legally and constitutionally you have a right to that extra time. Like everybody else, I hope you make it on the first deadline. I think that would solve everybody's problems. Well, it would only obviously go, if it were passed by both houses, it would only go into effect when the original deadline, but what I mean is if you could still get your three states by the original deadline, I think everybody would breathe a sigh of relief. The other thing wouldn't need to go into effect until after the original deadline. Yes. Well, I thought maybe you'd answer that question for me here today. No, I think I would inevitably, and I'll answer that, but I would inevitably bring to it some of my own background, some of my own prejudices about the areas that I had worked in. And I'd like to, again, ask Stuart if she would chime in on this one. I would like to see something done, mostly because I've worked in the juvenile and the institutionalized. I realize a small segment of our women find themselves in those circumstances, but I just have seen such dreadful exploitation there. I would really like to see somebody take a hard look at the way women are treated in captive institutions and to do something statutorily about that. I'm very interested in the juvenile field because I think it's hard enough to be a woman, but boy, if you start off life being a girl with a juvenile record and also have gone through your adolescence in some of those kinds of court systems and institutions, then you have an even harder cross to bear. Let me take a quick look here. In terms of the department, my own feeling basically is that the greatest statutory strides that can be made for women probably are in the non-justice field. I mean, I happen to work in the Department of Justice, but I think economics are really at the base of almost everything. And when you start talking about jobs and Social Security and tax breaks and those kind of things, that's where the real statutory and welfare reform, that's where the gut statutory issues are. I think the justice inevitably works, except in the field of sex discrimination, where it can be very important, obviously, in trying to break down these barriers in other institutions. But we do have most of the power, I think, that we need already on the books to bring those kinds of cases. I think that otherwise we're dealing with crime and with deviance and with more or less sort of the edges of the main problem. I would hope that we'll be able to get more women into the judiciary. I think women judges could make a great deal of difference in ruling on these other rights that come up under other statutes. But I think those are probably the area of greatest impact. Why don't you pick up and add to that?
Right. We certainly appreciate your participation this morning. We also would like to thank Mrs. Wald for her participation and all the informative information. I'd like to let you know that Tapes Unlimited will have available cassettes of this session together with your questions, which we hope were recorded, but we will have the answers on the cassettes. So feel free to purchase that, and thanks again for participating.